We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On this episode, occult knowledge. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Beatrice Groves and Dr. Amy Sturgis about the dark side of Harry Potter. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
This is an episode in our series devoted to conversations about chapters in our Potterversity companion book of essays. Today, we are looking at the creepier aspects of the books as we uncover their fascination with occult knowledge. Emily, now, would you say that you are attracted to the darker aspects of the Harry Potter books?
Yeah, yes, in a sort of fascinated, terrified sort of way. I'm definitely that sort of reader who's like, I can't, it's so awful, I can't look away, you know, but at the same time, it does have me kind of coming back for more. But I mean, for me, it's always like, you know, that dark stuff has to be sort of brought to the light, or that dark aspect of the plot has to be turned around by the heroes. So I'm always kind of in it for that sort of thing. You know, the darkness is there so that the light can shine.
Oh, I like that. That's very good. That's very Harry Potter for you.
Well, yeah.
Right. The darkest of times, right? Just need to know how to turn on the light.
What about you?
So I don't really love the darker bits, but I think that they highlight the lighter bits that I like so much. I like the humor and the delightful aspects and things that are warm and humanistic. But it helps you to feel those more intensely, I think, when you have that, you know, the converse, the yin yang of the, you know, there's this seamy underbelly and there are these threats to that the good, warm, you know, feeling and characters and all of that.
Right.
So I guess I understand why we need to have it.
Yeah.
I liked the epilogue. So that's what I'm bringing to it. Well, today we are going to explore the dark corners of Harry Potter in our discussion of Beatrice Groves' chapter, Good Men and Monsters, The Influence of Bram Stoker's Dracula on Harry Potter, and Amy Sturgis' chapter, Dark Arts and Secret Histories, Investigating Dark Academia, both of which appear in the Potterversity companion book. Dr. Beatrice Groves is fellow and tutor at Oxford University and the author of the book Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, a must-have resource for Potter scholars. I know Emily will agree with me on that.
Oh, yes.
Her MuggleNet blog is Batilda's Notebook, and she also blogs at Leaky Cauldron. Dr. Amy Sturgis teaches at Lenoir Rhine University and Signum University. Amy has published work on Harry Potter in anthologies such as Hogshead Conversations, Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and The Ravenclaw Reader. She also serves as staff on the Hugo Award-winning podcast Starship Sofa and editor-in-chief of Hocus Pocus Comics. Listeners, you can follow both Bea and Amy on Twitter, and we are delighted to welcome both of you to the show.
We're really pleased to be here. Thanks very much for inviting us.
Absolutely delighted. Thank you.
And Bea and Amy, you all have both been on the show on separate episodes, but this is the first time we're having you together. And I'm so excited to have you talk about these kind of darker edges of Harry Potter, and to kind of see, you know, what we think of sort of in common with the kind of Dracula elements, but also this kind of new genre of dark academia that Amy has identified. So, being Amy, what made you take a closer look at these more troubling, even grisly allusions and settings? And was it because you were personally drawn to those more disturbing elements of the books?
So the reason I started on this was just because I came across the idea in Dracula that they used the consecrated host to encircle Mina Harker when she was kind of turning over to the dark side, and that stopped her being able to move out of that space. And it reminded me of the fact that Matilda, when she is inhabited by Nagini, seems to be unable to meet Harry in the grave, in the churchyard. So we see her sort of outside. Harry says, have we seen someone in the bushes? You know, is someone watching us? And then she joins them when they leave the churchyard. So I just had that feeling that there was like a similar idea of a sort of holy space, kept safe, that the evil character couldn't get into. So I read Dracula as a result of thinking that, and was then, you know, blown away by quite how influential it is. Having read it, I thought, I think this is one of the most important books behind Harry Potter that there is. But I hadn't, because I hadn't read it before. I didn't know. So I'm entirely not drawn to the dark side. I say this is not my métier generally. It was just that specific path in. And prior to this, the only reason I'd looked at this sort of aspect in Harry Potter was via the Gothic, but only as mediated by Austen in Northanger Abbey. So I had gone completely down a comic parodic Gothic side. So in Literary Illusion, I'd written a chapter on Austen's influence on Rowling, and Jane Austen is Rowling's favourite author, so it's huge, and she's my favourite prose author as well, so we have that in common. So it was really fun sort of following that down. But it's the comic side, so not even like straight Gothic, but just this response to it in Northanger Abbey, and the way in which Rowling is also really drawn to the comic Gothic. So we think maybe of Nearly Headless Nick, you know, taking his head off and being really grumpy about the fact that he's not allowed to join the Headless Hunt or something. You're like, this is, you know, the idea of someone flipping their head off is incredibly Gothic, but yet it's done in this, you know, in this sort of light way. And my favourite link between those two is that when Henry Tilney is teasing Catherine and saying, you know, she has this mind craving to be frightened, so she's very much the reader who adores this side of literature, and he says, you know, are you prepared to encounter all the horrors that a building such as what one reads about might produce? And he says, have you nerves fit for sliding panels and tapestry? And I think that exact phrase was remembered by Rowling when Harry first enters Hogwarts. He goes to visit, you know, he goes up to the common room through sliding panels and hanging tapestries. Isn't that great? So I think this moment, like, that's Catherine's sort of imagination of what a Gothic building would be like, realised in Hogwarts. And she does, in one of Rowling's sort of early interviews, she talked about the first thing she imagined was Hogwarts as this, and I quote, big Gothic thing. and she says a place of sort of immense danger, but also great order. So she had this sort of idea of a Gothic building, and I think that's sort of central. And Hogwarts perhaps didn't, immense danger is not perhaps our experience of it. I think people feel more cozy about Hogwarts and certainly like the Room of Requirement, which you might think of as perhaps the sort of most Gothic thing, of a sort of this magical room that becomes whatever you desire and is completely changed by the psyche of the person who's encountering it, is in fact a almost entirely positive space that brings you these, you know, these lovely books for Hermione and cozy spaces to sleep in and all that kind of thing. It's actually not at all gothic in how it actually appears. So,
how about the Room of Chamber Pots?
Well, quite, right. But that's just, yeah, we're back to the
how
comic.
Convenient. Gothic.
Right, yeah, comic. That's right. And the bathrooms that appear when the girls join them and things like that.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm interested in that because, you know, you've got this, like you say, a kind of mediated understanding of the Gothic, and that was how you had first approached it. And then you're like, I'll read Dracula. And it's like, wow, like that's full on
the jugular, the full way. That's right.
Yeah. And listeners, if you have not read Dracula, you should totally read it when you're like ready to be seriously creeped out. It's a creepy book.
It is very dark. It is very dark, especially, I mean, from a religious perspective, it's like, ooh, there's a lot going on here that's, you know, inverting, you know, religious elements for, you know, evil purposes or to ward off evil and things like that. Touches a nerve.
Yeah. So, Amy, what about you? Were you personally drawn to those aspects? How did you get interested in the dark side of Harry Potter?
Well, I'm a goth girl through and through.
All right.
Always have been. There's nothing like a good ghost story or a deliciously dark and stormy night. That's my aesthetic from the beginning. And I teach a course on the Gothic tradition. I'll be teaching a course soon on dark academia. And I've written on the Gothic and Harry Potter and on various Gothic topics before. I'm drawn and always have been to dark fiction. In part, I think, because it holds up a mirror to timeless issues that, you know, we as humans deal with, we wrestle with, issues that trouble us, that make us feel helpless or hopeless or sleepless. The questions we don't have answers for, like death, which, of course, is at the core of the Harry Potter series.
Right.
And these kinds of stories allow us a format in which to work through our thoughts and our feelings and make leaps of empathy. And in that sense, feel not so alone at the fact that these are issues that concern us. But it also allows us to identify problems that do have solutions, problems we can tackle. And these stories, I think, allow us to break some of the things that frighten us down into constituent parts that then are things we can deal with, things we can approach in a way that allows us to solve some of these problems. And as for dark academia, which we'll be talking about a bit more, I'm a creature of academia. I'm a professor, but I'm also a lifelong student. And so stories set in schools, stories revolving around research, around asking questions and searching for answers, stories that celebrate libraries as the most creeptastic and natural places to be, right? That's playing my song.
So, Amy, why don't you define for us dark academia? This is something that the chapter in the Potterversity book does very well and really adds a much needed definition that has been a little tricky to work out. So how do you define dark academia?
In this case, I'm talking about the literary tradition or the storytelling tradition. There's also an aesthetic that's a completely different thing. They're related, but they have hugely important differences. But for the storytelling tradition of dark academia, I'd define it as having four major qualities. The first, of course, you get in the title there, the academia part. That's some kind of story that connects in some way to the project of academia. So main characters can be students, they can be faculty members, stories may be set or involve at least a non-residential school or a boarding school, a college or university campus, or even a related place like a library or a laboratory. And the ideas of, you know, research and learning are central. And also there's a challenge of a mystery. And sometimes this is simply discovering how to navigate the formal and informal and sometimes problematic system of the institution or the culture, or it may be a campus mystery, or maybe a personal mystery connected in some way. So in some way, these stories are connected to academics, to academia. And the second part of that definition, I would say, involves the Gothic. So we're already there. And the way I like to go at defining the Gothic is using Gerald Hogel's definition, or at least aspects of that, you know, sort of extrapolated from his discussion of what the Gothic is in the Cambridge Companion to Gothic Fiction. And he sets out the Gothic as stories that are rooted in setting. So an antiquated or seemingly antiquated space, he says. And of course, a campus like Hogwarts with its signature architecture and atmosphere.
Sliding panels and tapestries.
Exactly. And shifting stairways, right? And paintings that speak back to you. Also, it's absorbed with the past. And that can be, you know, as a subject of study, the past in general, or it can be a very recent personal past. And I think we see that with the students at Hogwarts, with their faculty members. You've got a multi-generational tale here involving personal pasts there at Hogwarts, and also associated with secrets, secrets that are physically or psychologically haunting. And of course, that's part of Harry Potter in a very big way. Harry discovering who he is, what's going on, and what has happened that sets up what will happen. And also involved with blurring the boundary between the natural and supernatural, and sometimes siding with the one, sometimes with the other. It could be psychologically, or it could be physically, or both. And dark academia can be mundane. It can be simply a regular story in which the sort of hints of supernatural are just scary elements that have perfectly logical explanations. But there's also a lot of dark academia works that are also speculative fiction, that combine science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction in some way or another. And so those tend to be more towards the super or extra natural. There. So we've got academia, we've got the Gothic. There's a mood, I think, that's the dark part of dark academia, and that emphasizes atmosphere and tragedy, often highlights the theme of death in some way, whether that's, you know, sort of morbid fascination with death, or research aimed at thwarting death, or even a social death, like being afraid of losing your reputation, or losing opportunity or dreams. But often it's about school-related, you know, disappearances or murders, or even suicides. And there's, you know, a lot of darkness also combined in fascinations that run amok, or relationships, or other things that give that mood that's that can be tragic, or that can be deeply scary or troubling. And most importantly, and I think this is the big deal, works of dark academia involve some kind of critique. They interrogate power dynamics, often shining a spotlight on things like exclusivity, privilege, inequality, hypocrisy. And these are all things that are, of course, in the world in general. But because everything is condensed down into the sort of fishbowl of a school, everything's very concentrated, and there we see writ small the problems of injustice in society writ large. And, you know, this can be things like faculty members abusing their power, students bullying their classmates. You know, we see both of these in Harry Potter. Secret societies, cliques, institutions resting on morally dubious foundations. But in the end, there is some sort of concern with issues that have created power inequalities or power dynamics, or there's some kind of critique embedded in dark academia works that say that, you know, we could do better. There are problems here. And I think we see that pretty clearly in Harry Potter, everything from the way He's treated by certain faculty members and, political figures, as well as, of course, issues of bullying. He sees the inequalities of, coming up against a student who doesn't like him or his friends whose father can buy the other team all their brooms and can also get a hippogriff nearly executed, right? There's just a whole lot of issues there that we can see in Harry Potter that are indicative of the way dark academia tries to shine a light on issues that should concern us and couch critique in this dark, gothic, campus-related story.
Yeah, so this I think leads to my next question, which is, you've got these the gothic elements, the focus on death, you've got all these power inequalities. How should we feel about all this being in works that are designed for young adult readers? So like the dark academia books have a lot of them are kind of targeted to younger readers, and the Harry Potter books, they were marketed as children's books, especially at the beginning. What do we think about the, should we be surprised that there's all this darkness and death and the gothic and that it's so popular?
Surprised or worried,
We should not be surprised at all. We were children. We know that you don't just learn reading and writing and arithmetic when we're young, right? We learn that life can be unfair. We learn that bullies lurk on the playground and in the classroom and next door. We learn that not all adults can be trusted. Young people understand that the world is a dangerous place because they experience this. And fiction allows them, just as it allows us, we're not kids anymore, but we get to live through that as well, through the fiction. This kind of storytelling allows us the opportunity to think through its implications, this unfair world, this dangerous world, to wrestle with complicated and troubling issues, to empathize with characters going through difficult times and feel like we're not alone, and young readers feel like they're not alone because they can identify with the bullied child, they can identify with the unfair situation at school. But this also allows stories to hold up examples of agency and heroism and hope for readers as well. I
Yeah, I
think,
think you see that when you are looking at, young people who are engaged in protest and, they're coming out with their signs and they're referencing Hunger Games and Harry Potter and Star Wars, because they are seeing, they have seen the critique in the fictional world and they are then applying that back in a very direct way, I think. And that it's getting young people, I would say, at a time when they don't know. I think that that's one of the things that I is a, like a theme of, I think both these chapters, the kind of, that there's knowledge that's hidden. And as children in an academic setting, like you have that sense of there are things to know and I want to know them, but wow, what if I learn something that's really going to be dangerous or that's going to show me some hard realities? And I think because they're young people, then that's able to be translated into the real world.
Right. Better to learn it in a book first than in, and be prepared for it in real life.
Yeah, and that's not to say that I don't think children are experiencing these things in real life as well. I like and school is real life. So I don't want to suggest that, but yeah, I mean kids have people who are close to them die. They have strange things happen. They experience abuse and Amy, as you said, things like bullying and power differentials and so yeah, so we
Global
don't,
pandemics.
right.
Right.
And that's not a new discussion either. I mean, I could go off talking about how writers like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis have written nonfiction pointing out that young people already know fear and threat and injustice and loss, and it does them a great disservice to deny them fiction that addresses the realities which they're already very aware, but suffice it to say, I agree.
Yeah, and J.K. Rowling also satirizes the kind of the cleansing of stories for children of their scary elements in the tales of Beetle the Bard, when what? she has Albus Dumbledore complaining about the way that they've been sanitized and infantilized, and that, you know, this, and I think Rowling knows that you can talk to children in a way that acknowledges that there are some difficult things out there, and that you're preparing them in a way for that.
And right. I think we get that too, don't we, with Umbridge is sort of changing of what they can study, and there's no need for you to use wands, you can just read about it and you don't have to kind of experience the dark arts at all. And this sort of say this is a sort of form of barbarization of what they're studying.
Absolutely, right? With the idea that, you know, there's no need for you to worry about that because we adults are going to take care of everything. And of course, the kids all know that's not correct.
right. This is, I mean, book five, after all, you know, like they've had four other books.
I don't know if it's true. I don't know what the evidence is for this. I don't know if any of you know, but some people have suggested that Dumbledore's army and the Order of the Phoenix swapped names at some point. So the way in which the Order of the Phoenix is the title of the book, and yet the adult organization is really quite minor in our experience of that novel. It's definitely the one along with Goblet of Fire where you think the title doesn't really have so much to do with the novel, and that maybe Dumbledore's army, which is a much bigger part of the novel, was originally the Order of the Phoenix, and the adult one was originally Dumbledore's army. And I don't, as I say, I don't know what the evidence of that. I've just heard people moot that as an idea, and that would be quite nice as well in terms of whether it's the adults or the children who are kind of, negotiating this battle with Voldemort. And we obviously know it's going to have to be the children who bring it to an end.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah. And that battle is the big battle is the Battle of Hogwarts. It's at the school. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, and if you think about the epigraph, you know, from Aeschylus.
Yes, absolutely. You know. Absolutely. That's definitely what she was doing with that epigraph. And she did use that in Twitter when there was the school walkout over guns in America. She used that epigraph there to sort of explicitly link the two. But I think just changing the topic a bit, but coming in because of that epigraph, this one of the things that Aeschylus epigraph is doing is talking about cycles. So obviously the Oresteia is based on the idea that you cycle through each generation, plays out the sins of the previous generation, and that family is in fact playing back the sort of sins of a distant ancestor who fed his child to the gods, and you can't get away from it. And that's played out most clearly in Harry Potter through the relationship between Harry's parents' generation and his generation. Mm-hmm. Obviously we see various aspects of that, but one of the things that reading Amy's chapter made me think of was the way in which the Marauders' backstory, the schoolmates who transform themselves, roam the grounds in a sort of dangerous form that could have led to the death of someone, you know, the way in which they're not that bothered by the fact that they're allowing Lupin to travel a school grounds as a werewolf, who, if he meets a child, would make them, you know, turn them into a werewolf. Reminded me of the secret history. I suddenly thought this is kind of like the secret history happening in the past of these, where the kids roaming and murdering someone. This is the sort of a dark version of Marauder's story. And I wondered, Amy, if you'd thought of that or whether you like that as an idea.
Oh, that's fascinating. I can absolutely see what you're saying there. And some of the works that have come since the secret history sort of building on that, this idea of the secret study of something sort of unsupervised and then taken to a different level. I think the psychological twisting of you know, people of good intentions who then become fixated on something. That's not what we see with the Marauders, but I can see the parallel there where
But they do so the secret knowledge that they turn into animagi, which they shouldn't have learned to do, in the sense that you're meant to obviously report to the ministry if you are an animagi, and they they don't. So they're unregistered animators. So they've studied hard to learn this secret knowledge, which, as you say, they're using for good, but using for good in a way that they haven't really thought through the dangers of. I certainly think, you know, how often Harry is out at night in the grounds, and if he was just to meet a werewolf, that would have been, you know, a bit dangerous. But we do know that Rowling's read The Secret History because the first non-fiction piece that she published in 1998, which was an article in the Exeter Classics magazine, they sort of saw one of their alumni had published a book that seemed to be being quite popular. So they said, oh, write us a piece. And she wrote something called That Nymph Again. And she starts it with a quote from Nietzsche. And then it's, you know, it's incredibly high culture reference. And then she sort of starts the article saying there's nothing like a pithy quotation to get the ball rolling. So in the noble tradition of undergraduates anxious to give the impression of extensive background reading, I've stolen one from a book I have never read. But by happy chance, Donna Tartt chose this very gobbit to preface her novel, The Secret History, which I have read.
It's convenient.
It's convenient, isn't it? So there's obviously, this is making a sort of self-deprecating joke there, which is rather funny, but I just thought it might be of interest for this discussion that she has read The Secret History, which seems to me quite a sort of starter for the dark academic genre.
One that has been identified as a sort of foundational text for this sort of modern explosion of dark academia. I would take the definition much further going back, but absolutely.
In terms of sort of popularity and sort of, that one and sort of took off, didn't it?
You know, you're also now making me think, that's such a great connection to make. Thank you for that. Now you're also making me think about, you wouldn't have The Secret History without Brideshead Revisited. Mm-hmm. And there are some really interesting connections between the Harry Potter series and this idea of a sort of privileged, enchanted world that we know is falling apart at the seams, and what won't be recaptured in the way, you know, because of a whole number of factors. But I think you've put me on now. My wheels are spinning.
And I certainly think that beginning of Brideshead is the sort of the absolute, you know, as someone who is at Oxford, it's always say to people if they're coming up to Oxford, just read the beginning of Brideshead. You'll just give this sort of the such a romantic picture of what life at Oxford is like. And it's such a, it seems to be, it's the acme of Oxford romance, isn't it? That opening and the gillyflowers round the window. And
something else that fascinates me in thinking about this is that's also connected, both Secret History and Brideshead, connected to this aesthetic of dark academia, which is its own thing that has its own fashion and its own home decor and photography and even paper dolls. And it's very much a creature of TikTok and Instagram and online communities, and a much more recent phenomenon than the storytelling. But those are two texts that keep repeating. And one of the things that separates the aesthetic from the storytelling is a romanticization of things that, in fact, the storytelling critiques. And so things like privilege and exclusivity and a kind of nostalgia for a time when everyone knew their place, and a sort of excessive coziness connected to privilege and some things that are really brought up in dark academia, is things that need to be subjects that need to be interrogated and have, you know, light shone on them. And Harry Potter does sort of at times straddle that line. And I think perhaps that's a reason why Harry Potter does get some critique now, and perhaps scrutiny from those who are also looking at the aesthetic and saying there's some deeply problematic veins running through the aesthetic that are part and parcel of the project of the storytelling to really wrestle with and question. So there's a whole lot of interrelatedness here, really interesting strands that I'd like to tease out a bit more. You've really got my wheels turning. I love this. Thank you so much.
And how interesting that kind of, that there's an ambivalence that you get even from the narrative, right? That there are things that are romanticized, but also like also under critique at the same time. And so the author can kind of have both of those in there. And so it's up to the reader to, you know, to actually put all of that together into a, like takeaway idea.
And I was thinking reading Amy's essay about also the magicians, which seemed to me the Lev Grossman novels, because those are sort of explicitly sort of Harry Potter related. So he said, you know, I wrote these while I was waiting for the next Harry Potter novel to come out, you know, but they obviously take them in a much darker direction. So it's sort of explicitly related but darker. But I love, there's a moment in it which I just thought was so funny when he did it, where he has a game, you know, called Welters, which you just think, oh come on, this is just Quidditch. And at one point someone says, I'll go and fetch my Quidditch, sorry, Welters robes. And I thought, oh, good on you for just going, yep, we all know exactly why I invented this game. But yeah, I wondered, Amy, whether you've whether the magicians sort of is something you look at as well in terms of sort of a explicitly, I think sort of explicitly feminist in some ways with the Julia emphasis, and also, yeah, clearly more adult in terms of sexual content and things as a response to Harry Potter.
Yes. Yes, that's, in fact, I'm working on an extended reading list for my class, and that's absolutely on there. Magic for Liars would be another, I would say, is explicitly taking on the Harry Potter series as another, that's Sarah Gailey, by the way, another work that is clearly in conversation with, that is also dark academia. But absolutely, magicians would be on that list.
You know, I love the idea that the genre kind of invites consistent critique even on itself. You know, but you can start the conversation and then you can always take that critique even further.
Yeah. Well, I love what I'm hearing about how it seems to expect a lot from readers. And I always think that readers can handle that and that more books should expect a lot of readers. And it definitely seems like the dark academia, I don't know if we want to call it a movement or a trend or what. It definitely seems to fall in that category.
He and Amy, in your chapters, each of you is explaining how Rowling is working within a certain set of genre or illusory expectations. You know, how she's building the dark academia setting, or she's, you know, playing off of these motifs from Dracula. But to what extent does she break with these expectations? And what's the effect of those choices that she's making?
So with the Dracula connection, that there are a number of very close connections with Dracula, which I discuss in my essay. But I did feel that what she was doing by setting up these extensive connections with the scar, the blood, and the Horcruxes, all forming a link with the way in which Dracula worries about the miscegenation of evil. So these good characters, you know, Mina Harker's entirely morally good, but when Dracula drinks her blood, she then turns into a vampire. And you can see her saying, you know, I wanted him, you know, to violate me, basically, that he becomes desirable, and that the erotics of evil is something that she succumbs to powerlessly because he has physically attacked her. So that the physical attack is something that changes your moral being. And I felt that Harry Potter was intent on overturning that completely, that Harry is physically attacked by Voldemort. He is given this scar. He becomes a Horcrux, in fact. He has a part of the Dark Lord's soul lodged within him. But his essential self is never changed by that. He is pure of heart in the beginning, the point where he sees the Philosopher's Stone and sees only how to overcome Voldemort through, in the Mirror of Erised, and Dumbledore says to him, you know, that the Dark Lord should have realized then that he was never going to be able to possess you, never going to be able to beat you, because you have a purity of heart that he does not understand. Your ability to love can push him out. So whereas Mina Harker loves her husband, but that love is clearly going to be completely subsumed by her vampirism if they don't manage to kill Dracula, whereas Harry is not. You know, when he feels his love for Dobby and for Sirius as grief, it pushes out the power of the Dark Lord. When the Dark Lord tries to possess him in the fight in the Ministry, when Quirrell touches him at the beginning, that causes the Dark Lord pain, not Harry. Whereas that's the inverse of what happens to Mina. Dracula, it's never suffers from the fact he's in contact with goodness. It's goodness that suffers from contact with him. So I felt that Stoker is interested in the decadent. He's interested in these sort of the erotics of evil. He's basically sort of trying to undermine a certain Victorian morality. Whereas Rowling is doing the opposite. She's trying to emphasize the importance and the power of good in a culture which is more interested in a sort of Stoker decadence. So both of them are countercultural, just in their inner completely different cultures, as it were. So I felt that this, it's an interesting overturning of actually what Dracula's about, which is exploring the links.
Right. And your title, Good Men and Monsters, I think speaks to, you know, that argument that you're making. And one of the elements, I think, too, that is really a kind of cool addition there is you talked about Mina's powerlessness. And over and over again, Rowling tells us, the Harry Potter series tells us, that Harry has choices and that he's able to choose the good.
Exactly. And that phrase, a power the Dark Lord knows not, and Harry's like, oh, it's just love again, isn't it? And it's like, yes, it's just love again. This is a power, that this is not powerlessness. And just interestingly, linking there, so John Granger pointed this out in Harry Potter's bookshelf, that Harry is linked to Gothic heroines. You know, throughout Gothic, we have characters like Mina Harker, but also sort of Jane Eyre to an extent, going back, I don't know, Cinderella or something, these sort of oppressed and abused women. So we think of Jane Eyre locked in the Red Room and Harry locked in the cupboard under the stairs, that he takes on this position, which has been a feminine position in literature of sort of fighting against this powerlessness. And so I think that's interesting for what Rowling wants to say about the strength of the good that is oppressed, in changing over the gender expectations there.
That's great. And you actually made me just think, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but the Kenneth Branagh Cinderella also emphasizes, you know, the choice to be kind, right? And that this goodness does have a power to defeat the oppressor in a way.
And just as we're talking about Dracula, I just want to get in that, did you know that we are almost to the day recording on the a century after the first ever Dracula movie, Nosferatu, which came out on, I think, the 5th of March.
That's a great film.
1922. So I thought that we should mark the fact that we are doing that.
Of course, wow. Amy, the eternal goth girl, loves Nosferatu.
You know it.
And I do think that I'm sure Cuaron in Azkaban, that he is basing the way in which Peter Pettigrew looks when he turns into the rat on the rat Dracula. So there's the bright eyes and the pointy teeth and the paleness. If you look at the face as he transforms into the rat, thinking of Count Orlok, you'll think, yes!
Wow.
The visual parallel with Dracula has been brought in by the director, not necessarily with any, I think, awareness of the Dracula parallels in the series. I think that's really just the both of them going for the gothic. It's like the way that Cuaron brings in Macbeth references in that with the Toil and Trouble song. And again, Macbeth is going to be huge in Harry Potter 5, which is the parallel novel to Harry Potter 3. But I think it's just, they're just thinking of witchy references there. But it's really fun that happens in the films as well as the novels.
So Amy, what do you think about this question about the breaking with dark academia? And now she's actually part of the, maybe almost like a formulation of the genre. So, you know, do you see her breaking with it at all? Or is she setting the definition in some important ways?
First of all, I think it's important to point out that dark academia is by its very nature sort of a flavor that can be added with other flavors. And so the fact that Harry Potter, each individual novel, and then the novels as a whole as one big story, has or represents multiple genres. That's not a breaking with. I would say that's actually a consistency with dark academia, that you see that Harry Potter is doing fantasy and it's doing mystery and it's doing multiple things. That's part of dark academia. So I think that's, she's not breaking with it by involving other genres in her storytelling. And I think it's important that Harry Potter does qualify as dark academia and that we recognize that, because it means then that this tradition, this genre on its own, includes the best-selling book series of all time, and by virtue of being ubiquitous, it has lasting cultural cachet, right? It's got visibility, it's purchase, it has lasting influence on readers and writers and the culture. And it gives us also, as Potter scholars, another way to look at Harry Potter by recognizing that it is part of dark academia. But to be perfectly honest, as far as breaking away is concerned, I think looking at what's happening now, and particularly in the explosion of dark academia that's happened since 2017, it's a bit more like dark academia has broken away from Harry Potter and not the other way around. And I can give you a quick quote here, a two-line quote. Amy Gentry, who's both an author of dark academia and also a scholar, said in 2021 in her Crime Reads article, "Dark Academia, Your Guide to the New Wave of Post-Secret History Campus Thrillers," she says, "Perhaps there's one more way to explain the dark academia trend." I'm quoting here. "A generation of Harry Potter loving children were raised on the idea that a perfect combination of pure heart, ancient birthright, and excellent study skills could dispatch any villain, all grown up and heartbroken by Rowling's anti-trans hate speech and shallow commitment to diversity. They may rightly question whether hallowed halls and sacred traditions can ever be a place for real rebellion." And that's the end of the quote. And I think a lot of the works we see in this new explosion post 2017 show that offering something like real rebellion, as Amy Gentry calls it, is possible, or at least they are trying to push back. The authors of these works are trying to push back against things they're dissatisfied with in the Harry Potter series. So that means showing genuine diversity in the topics covered and the voices represented, and that also means the critiques offered are different or more diverse than we see in the Harry Potter series. And if I may, I'll give you two examples of new works that I see as doing something different. The first, a really brilliant book, came out in 2020, and the sequel is coming out in 2022 by Tracy Dion. I'm excited about teaching this work. She is a two-time graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Tracy Dion, and so she takes the campus she knows very well, the campus whose history she knows very well, and she uses UNC Chapel Hill as a backdrop to tell a story that's a collision of European Arthurian romance and African root magic, but all that's in the service of confronting the legacy of power disparity, of hypocrisy, racism, politics in the US South in general, but it's also embodied literally in the physical campus of UNC Chapel Hill. And
And
so she takes
what's the name of that book, Amy?
that is Legendborn.
Legendborn, okay.
All one word, Legendborn. And you can see there how taking this real place that this author knows and saying, now we're going to drill down and confront and then try to, respond to and overcome the history embedded in this place using these traditional magical stories from multiple cultures, right? That you can see how that's doing something different and maybe pointing out some of the blind spots or weak spots of the Harry Potter series. And another one I'll point out, by an author whose work I really deeply admire, will be coming out at the end of at fall 2022. R.F. Kuang, a Chinese American author. She is publishing a new work of dark academia called Babel, or The Necessity of Violence: An Arcane History of the Oxford Translators Revolution. And the tagline for that is, "An act of translation is always an act of betrayal." It's set in Oxford. It's set up as, the center of all knowledge and progress in the world. And yes, there's going to be quotes around that. And in its center is Babel, the Royal Institute of Translation, the tower from which all the power of the empire flows. And this is being described as a novel about the power of language, the violence of colonialism, and the sacrifices of resistance. And I know you, Katie, have written about colonialism and certain aspects of the Harry Potter series. And that's certainly another area that broadly has been criticized in the Harry Potter series. And you can see, I think, using that example, how this work is also setting up this, British sort of iconic place, but then in order to interrogate a lot of the assumptions that go into that, and how language has power, and what colonialism looks like institutionalized. And so again, you can see that these works are really attempting to fill in parts of the conversation that haven't been discussed as much. And I think it's a sign of a very healthy and vibrant genre in the making that these works are coming out. But I think it's also worth pointing out that they are defining themselves in a sense against some of the things they see in Harry Potter as problematic and as perhaps not as dedicated to an objective critique or
Maybe
a
even unexamined,
exactly.
assumptions.
That's a much better way to put it. But maybe driven by, unexamined assumptions, they're trying to examine those assumptions. And so it's part of this conversation, but not always as an inspiration, but perhaps as a position to, set themselves up against, to push back against, which I think is, again, very vibrant and very healthy, and I'm excited to see these works and see this conversation continuing. But it is, in a sense, maybe the genre is building on Harry Potter, but maybe leaving its author behind in some senses.
And I will just give a plug in advance for Dr. Sturgis's Signum course on dark academia. I have taken myself, I can testify, I've taken many courses with Amy Sturgis, and they are always, always riveting. So, Signum University, it's all
Thank you.
online. Signum has been doing online courses since way before the pandemic, 10 years, whatever. And so they really do it right. So I did, Katie, I think I shared with you, I had a listener reach out to me recently. And he was really excited about studying, these elements of popular culture, but he was kind of like, where do I go with this? And I sent him to Signum University, and I plugged Amy's courses in particular. So if you're interested in dark academia and what Amy's talking about here, folks, check out the course. Do you two think that looking at Harry Potter in relation to works like Dracula, and the dark academia novels, do you think it points to the problems of knowledge of the dark arts more generally? I mean, how should we go about learning from these darker aspects of the series?
Knowledge is never the problem. Okay, I've got two parts to my answer here on this. First of all, on the one hand, it's what you do with the knowledge you have. So if I apply, for example, the definition of dark academia retroactively and try to find an early pioneering text that sets all of this in motion, I would go back to Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's Frankenstein, which I do all the time anyway, because it's brilliant. And to use that as an example, Victor Frankenstein in Frankenstein, which, as I've just said, is a work you can see as a predecessor to today's dark academia, he pursued his own research, removed from any kind of institutional or organized form of accountability. He removes himself from his professors. He removes himself from his classmates, anyone who could have held him accountable. And then he fails to hold himself accountable. So his downfall comes not from pursuing knowledge, but from failing time and time and time again. He's given so many opportunities to take responsibility for his actions. He created and then failed to accept responsibility for his creation.
That's right. He just abandons the creature to exactly. just he sets it loose on the world without really trying to cope with what he has created.
Right. And that's not a problem of dark arts. It's a problem of Victor being a deadbeat dad. Right. And so in that sense, I think the repeated story over and over again is one of what you do with knowledge, not the knowledge itself. But on the other hand, the second part of my answer is that dark academia as a storytelling movement or as a genre emphasizes repeatedly that it's not knowledge, but secrets that are the problem. Whether that's as ominous as, you know, the self-serving agenda of the secret society, or as terrible as the open secret of who abuses power and in what ways, or really as invisible as the secret, the way the things have always been done. I mean, the secret knowledge insiders have that outsiders don't, such as how to navigate the institution system. That's knowledge a legacy student would take for granted, because the legacy student knows what the parents and grandparents and all the way back did. That's the way it's always been done.
Right. But and that's like Ron, you know, who knows exactly. how the world works, and Harry just doesn't. Yeah.
Right. Right. And a first generation scholarship student today perhaps doesn't have access to that same insider knowledge, and yet is held accountable for things that have never been, you know, opened in the air. So when knowledge is open and accessible, a lot of the darkness in dark academia disappears. It's dispelled by the light. So I would say secrets are the problem.
Yeah, I'm thinking too about Bee's point about Dolores Umbridge, who, you know, she's supposed to be teaching. And I think it's interesting, right? They have a dark arts class, but it's defense against the dark arts. So it's not like how to employ dark arts magic, but it's, you know, it's sort of, you have to know it so you can respond to it. But Dolores Umbridge is, she's just like, no, we're going to put a curtain on all that, right? You don't need to know that. And that is, you know, she's making it secret. I was thinking also about the restricted section of the Hogwarts library, you know, maybe we should just open all that up. I don't know. should we all know how to make a Horcrux?
It's important that those books are there. They can be accessed, right?
No, and that's true. Yes.
And Umbridge, I think the perfect foil to that is Lupin when he's teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts, right? He throws the wardrobe door open and we see what the blog art is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a key example there. What hurts Harry the most and the source of so many emo Harry moments is not knowing what's going on.
Right.
Right. And again and again, knowledge is power, and the secrets are the things that are the rot, if you will, under the floorboards. And so I would say knowledge is never the problem, for a variety of reasons. It's what you do with it, and it's not knowing that is the real source of the darkness there.
Yeah, very Gnostic of you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you, I think.
Well, thank you so much, Bee and Amy, for joining us on the show today. Now, listeners, we have only touched the surface of what they talk about in their chapters, so you're going to want to read their full chapters. To do that, pick up the Potterversity companion book and then let us know what you think. Today, we're going to end with the words of Headmaster Albus Dumbledore, who said, "It is the unknown we fear when we look upon death and darkness. Nothing more."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.